Time to take a look at home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues relating to your home and mine, as a matter of fact. John Merrill, housing specialist, professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, is our guest with us by phone today from Georgia. John, are you there?
I am here, Larry. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you with us. Probably a little warmer in Georgia than it is right here.
I was just sitting by the pool outside enjoying the sun, yes.
Oh, boy.
To rub it in a little bit.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's still cold here, and you haven't forgotten about that. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to be wondering about tightening up their home or things they can do to fix the home. And just to go along with that, my wife and I had an energy audit of our home just a couple weeks ago. And we're going to be making some changes based on those recommendations.
Good.
It's quite an interesting experience to go through one of those energy audits. We had a camera. Mark Canvick was our guy, and he had a camera that showed, you know, where the cold spots were around the house, inside and out, and had quite a list of recommendations. I don't know if you've ever had that done with your house. Probably not, because you're already one of those experts, but it was quite an education.
Well, I have not had the infrared camera done. I haven't had the blower door test done. And both of those techniques are really helpful to find things that you might not think are problems. I know I've seen cases in the past where people discovered that there's a little bit of a wall that wasn't insulated, and the rest of the house is insulated, and that there were sort of vault ceilings that allowed air to get into the attic and cause ice dams that they hadn't known about. So it's a good idea.
Yeah, it really is. We already have a number of callers online, a few callers anyway. You can still join us, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll be glad to get you on. We do have a couple of open lines. And Dick in Iron River is up first, so let's go to Dick. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about, I have a new home that was just delivered on December 12th on a poured basement. It's got casement windows. I expected a lot of ice buildup this first winter on the glass. What I didn't expect was to have a frost buildup on the wood frames around the casement where the frames meet the main frame of the window. It's not uniformly distributed on the frame. It's on some corners, up on the sides or tops, sometimes along the hinge sides, sometimes along the lock sides. And I'm thinking it might be the weather seal on it. I do have a constantly operating air-to-air exchanger. Humidity levels in the day run about 32%, at night about 32%, during the day about 24%. So I'm wondering if this is just something I need to live with this first year, or I have a problem that I'll need to look at the manufacturer with.
What do you think, John?
Well, I mean, you've clearly thought this through. It is true that when there's concrete and sheetrock, the first year there's an awful lot of moisture escaping from the materials as they dry out, and that can make humidity levels high. But you've got a heat recovery ventilator operating, and that's controlling the humidity. So even though it's being generated, it should be being removed. So I'm surprised that the first thing I would have said is you have too high a humidity level, but that's obviously not the case. You should probably be sure that you have an independent determination of whether your humidity level is in fact accurate as provided you by the area heat exchanger. It's possible that's not calibrated properly. But if that is, then I think you need to deal with the window manufacturer.
That just doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, I didn't think it sounded right. I could see if it was uniformly distributed around the wooden frames, but it appears some places where the locks are holding the frame real tight against the main frame that there isn't any leakage, or where the hinges are real tight, there's nothing there.
No, it sounds like the weather stripping may be missing or not being effective. Have you do you notice any breezes coming in through the...
No.
Yeah.
When I talked to the window manufacturer this morning, they said what I was experiencing was the warm, moist air leaking out, not the cold air coming in, which I thought that's leaking either way isn't good.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, what's actually happening is that there's a cold space right there. Whether it's air leaking in or out, there's a cold space where there's not as much insulation as there is around it. And that's what would cause the icing to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Why that is happening is what the question is. I mean, that you expect it on the windows because windows have a lower insulating value than your walls, as do the window frames. But the window frames should have an insulating value of 2 or 3 and should not be causing problems. You aren't getting problems elsewhere in your house. And what I'm hearing you say is there's some frost in the windows, but there's at least as much on the frames.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of ice along the bottom edge of the window, but I expect that this first year. It's just that around the perimeter on the wood on the frames that it's not at all uniform. I'm just thinking leakage. I have some sliding patio doors here, 9-footers, and I would think they'd be much leakier, but they have pretty much no problem at all.
Yeah. Sounds like there's something wrong with the seals.
Yeah, you better. Well, what do you do, John? Do you have somebody come in and take a look at it then, or what? Since it's a new home, I would say
go back to the manufacturer. If you don't get satisfaction from the manufacturer, then you might want to talk with one of the folks, like the person Larry had do his energy assessment, and have them look at the windows and give you some more ammunition to use with their manufacturer.
Yep. Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks, Dick. Matt in Laval, we'll go to you next. Hi, Matt.
Yes, I'm building a new house, and I want to use dimmer switches in the house, but I don't think you can use fluorescent lighting, or I've heard you can. And how do you find those kind of fluorescent lights that you can use with dimmer switches?
How do you find fluorescent lights that you can use
dimmer switches with?
Yeah.
Right now, I'm pausing because I don't have a ready answer for you.
Okay.
There are lots of dimmer switches now that are great with the incandescent lights. That used to be that they didn't save energy. They just cut your light levels down. Now they're really effective. But with the, I would expect with compact fluorescents you can do it. I think I've seen them, but I don't know where. Perhaps someone will call with a source.
All right. One quick other question. What R rating do you suggest for the attic?
At least R38.
At least R38.
That's sort of the minimum code required.
Yeah. But
if you have space, people are typically putting in several inches more. That equates to about 12 inches of insulation.
Right.
And if you have room for 15 or 16, R40, R50 are not uncommon.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, talking home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues with John Merrill. And let's go to Toby in Portage next. Toby, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have a question about re-roofing, but I can answer on that previous question if you like.
Sure, go ahead.
Either you're going to have tubes, fluorescent tubes in your fixtures, or you're going to be screwing in the replacement bulbs, the fluorescent screw-in type that replace the incandescent bulbs. If you have tubes in your fixtures, you can get a dimming ballast with a controller that dims the lights, and those are going to be available at an electrical supply house. I actually have a light shelf with four-foot fixtures in it, and it has the dimming ballast that controls all three of the ballasts, and then there's a dimmer that controls that. However, if you're looking at the screw-in types that replace the conventional incandescent bulbs, then I don't have knowledge of that, and you would have to go to an electrical supply house or consult an electrical contractor that deals and has had experience with that sort of dimmer. So I'm not actually aware of dimmers that would control those screw-in type fluorescent lamps.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much. And now you have a question as well, I believe. Or
yes,
do you?
The house is it's got a hip roof that comes up to a point. It's got 412 pitch, 3 stone chimneys. And I'm really interested in re-roofing with standing seam metal roof? So that's one question. And then the second question is, and also there's the upper part of the roof has an attic, and the lower sections of the roof are vaulted ceilings with nothing but the rafters between the room ceiling and the sky. The second question has to do with the possibility of putting foam insulation that's bonded to plywood. I've been on construction sites where they'll have sheets of plywood that have 2 or 3 inches of foam bonded to them as a single piece, and those are screwed onto the structure, and then the roofing goes over that. It could be shingles, or it could be standing seam metal roof. So I guess I'd like to ask you about that insulation option, and and then if you have any information about standing seam metal roof.
What would you like to know about standing seam?
Well, is it would it in and of itself solve my ice damming problems?
Well, it certainly is much slipperier. The problem with standing seam roofs is the ice slides off and creates hazards when it hits things.
Okay.
So there usually are little fixtures added to the roof that are snow breaks that break up that. But it would not eliminate the fact that roofs will freeze where it's not where it's cold, and where air is leaking in through the attic, it will not freeze. And you'll have leakage of water running down underneath the snow to where it's frozen. Then it'll build up. That's the basic principle of an ice dam.
Yeah.
And while the snow will slip off more easily, I'm not sure that it will stop that freezing on a cold roof.
So it's an insulation question or an issue inside the
Right. It's more of a heat air leakage and insulation question inside of the weather compartment, the heated area, the conditioned area of your house, and the attic above it.
Well, the upper portion of the roof has the attic space with good access, and that is very well ventilated. I make a point of really trying to keep that ventilated so that the temperature inside the attic is very close to the outside temperature.
Good, and that's what you should be doing. But in addition, you should be sure that there is no air leakage into the attic.
Okay.
That's some of the studies that have been done in the last 10 or so years have found that the biggest factor influencing ice dams is not so much the lack of insulation as it is the air leaking into the attic and warming it up. So making sure that you don't have any thermal bypasses or any air leakages into that area would be important. You were saying earlier that the vaulted ceiling part of your house does not have any insulation. It's basically the roof and then the...
It is 2x4 rafters with 6 inches of fiberglass between...
Okay.
2x8 rafters. 2x8 rafters with 6-inch fiberglass bats. And then, you know, sheetrock on the inside and plywood on the outside with the shingles.
Right. And that obviously is not the recommended amount of insulation for those areas, and I suspect there that you are getting some heat loss through that.
Oh, yeah.
So the foam would, for one thing, it would make sure you didn't have any air leakage through there. If you had either using your system or having foam sprayed in.
No, I'm thinking of in terms of you tear off the existing roofing and then you re-sheet the roof with this foam bonded to plywood material.
And why are you thinking of that, going to that extent, rather than having somebody spray foam in?
I don't want to tear off the sheetrock. I don't want to disturb the interior finish.
All right, good. So that's why you're doing that. Makes sense. So you're going to be adding several inches of insulation and then new sheathing.
Yeah, so you'd be on top of the plywood, existing plywood roof deck. You would be putting, let's say 2 to 3 inches of foam that's bonded to this plywood layer that then your roofing, your metal standing seam roofing goes over that. So you've got, you're going to have foam insulation directly under your metal roof.
Right. And you're also going to have an airspace between your old deck and your, or your foam and your bats.
Well, your existing is going to stay the way it is. It's, you know, the rafters with the fiberglass and then the plywood on top of that.
Right,
and you're putting another layer of foam.
I understand that.
And plywood on top of that.
But what I heard you saying is that between, you're going to leave the existing as it is, and you have an airspace above the bats below the deck.
Yes.
Not. Yeah.
Yeah, and that is very well ventilated. There's inlets at the lower end, and it outlets into the attic space, and it's ventilated out from there.
Right. That's what I thought you were saying. What that's going to do is vastly reduce the effectiveness of your foam that you're adding on the top, because you're going to be having a cold air layer going up underneath that foam.
Okay.
So to me, that's a, you know, a serious problem with your proposal.
And why are you going to end up with a cold air flow
you have
above the fiberglass?
The you said you had 6 inches of insulation and probably a little airspace above that, and then your deck, your shingles, right?
Existing, yeah.
On the hip group, the vaulted ceiling roof.
Yeah.
That air is going to go up under the existing deck and exit out. And any insulation that's over that is going to be not as effective because there's this cold air flowing underneath it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, so that the ventilation that you normally would find desirable is going to...
Yep.
Okay, I see. I follow you.
So that, you know, that's a serious problem. I mean, the other thing that you could I've seen people do is you can raise the height of your rafters by scabbing on additional height for the rafters and add insulation that way and raise your roof if that works in your particular design.
Something to think about at least, Toby.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. John Merrill, our guest today, professor emeritus in the and housing specialist in the UW Madison School of Human Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're thinking about some energy-saving things for your home, or maybe you've got some renovation or repair issues, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Merrill. And, John, our next caller comes from Galesville. Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, got a question. I'd like the professor's opinion on ventless propane heaters, and what's the engineering behind that in terms of, is that any different than a vented propane heater in terms of the burner design?
I can't speak to the burner design, but the recommendations I've heard from lots of people are that any kind of heater that is unvented and it's used in conditioned space is problematic. And the reason is that it is, if it's operating properly, the combustion product should be fairly innocuous, but there is a lot of moisture being produced, and you have to deal with that moisture someplace.
Okay, so if it's if you've got a tighter construction type house, that moisture could cause a lot of condensation issues.
Right, because it's putting out a lot of moisture.
Okay.
That's just, and this is assuming that the propane heater is operating efficiently and isn't compromised at some place. If it gets compromised, if it gets dirty or something like that, some of the orifice is blocked, then you have carbon monoxide possibilities.
Okay.
So there, in many places, any kind of combustion heater that is unvented is illegal to use because of those the potential safety hazards as well as the condensation.
I was curious because I you see them for sale all the time in these home improvement places, the superstores. garage heaters and you know bog sets and all those kind of things. But
they're used frequently in places in construction sites where you have pretty open sites with lots of air leakage. But in a conditioned space where you're trying to make it tight, it's a different situation.
Okay, but the safety element of that, they really just rely on their oxygen depletion sensor then?
Right.
Okay. So your recommendation is I should cross that off my list for my house.
Yeah, I don't think it's the best way to get supplemental heat, unless you want to, certainly the kind that you can vent, which you can vent through the walls because they don't require a high heat vent, are reasonable choices.
The reason that I was looking was I have a house that, very old house, that has an 18-inch thick rock foundation.
Ooh.
And it's all electric now, and my options were pretty small numbered in terms of how I could add any other supplemental heat.
Have you thought about a off-peak storage heater, electrical storage heater? Is that a possibility where you live?
Don't know anything about those.
Well, you should check with your utility to see if they... For many years, utilities were trying to push these because that allowed them to have electricity used when it wasn't primed to keep their capacity going, and they would sell it to you at a cheaper rate. And these heaters had storage in them that would allow you to have the heat stored at night when the electric rate was cheaper, and then distributed during the day when you needed it.
Is that like a water-based heater,
some
tank of water?
Or? Some are water and some are brick. Or some kind of ceramic storage.
Okay. I will call and check. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jeff in Eau Claire, it's your turn now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I'm calling in response to the gentleman that was looking for screw-in type dimmable light bulbs.
Yeah.
You can buy, I have two brands offhand. One's called LightWiz, and their website is www.harmonylight.com.
Okay.
And the other one is Max Light, which I don't have any information about other than I have those and I have them screwed in and they work.
Max Light, okay.
Yeah, and you could find those on eBay. I haven't seen them in retail stores, so that's probably why the gentleman was not having any luck either.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Harmony Light and Max Light. All right. Let's go to Jonathan and Madison. Hi to you.
Hi. I had a question regarding the new energy efficient light bulbs, and I was looking at buying them for my apartment, but looking at them, there was a warning that there's mercury in them, and I guess I was just wondering if there's a certain way that these light bulbs need to be disposed, or, you know, if that mercury is a problem at all.
What do you think, John?
Well, I don't think there is a problem. The most... I believe that the recycling, Madison Recycling, requires that sellers of fluorescent bulbs accept them and accept the worn-out ones afterwards so that they can be recycled.
Okay.
So
I've not heard that as a concern. That doesn't mean it's not. But I have dealt with the people who are promoting the compact fluorescence, and that issue has not been a marketing issue that I've heard.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks, John. Kathy in Green Bay, we go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm going to plug something. We're having an energy forum here in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And it's the Greater Green Bay League of Women Voters are putting it on. It's going to be energy, environment, health. What is the connection? So we're covering a lot of issues there. The reason we're putting it on, too, is that... so many people that are building today, I've talking to other people, are telling me that they kind of make the decision when they're building, well, I could have solar heat or I can put granite countertops in. And they're putting granite countertops in instead of doing the solar heat. And also that a lot of people aren't aware of some of the things that are out there, that they are a lot more efficient than they used to be. There's a lot of misinformation. And we want to get this really out to people that they got to think of doing this now. You can't think about doing something 5 years down the road, because if you build now, 5 years down the road, your house is going to be out of date.
So when is the forum?
It's March 24th, and it's going to run from about noon until 4:30 at the downtown Green Bay Library.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to bring in cars, different types of cars. We're bringing in green builders. We're bringing in different type of energy sources, wind, solar, bio. We're bringing in some health experts. Just a whole gamut. It's called a forum because we want a discussion.
So it's March 24th, and where's the location again in Green Bay?
At the Downtown Central Library.
Downtown Central Library. Kathy, thanks. And John, that's a pretty good idea, isn't it?
Sounds like a great idea. We all need to be looking at that very carefully because the energy prices are only going to go up, and probably more dramatically. We really haven't seen the effect of the fact that we've passed peak petroleum production.
Yep.
So they're going to be going up.
Kathy, I thank you very much. That's March 24th. And Tim in Waupaca, we go to you next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just a couple questions. In regards to attic insulation, I'm at a point in my house that I'm building. I insulated the bottom cord with R11, which evened it out with the bottom cord of the trusses. And I have an option of using bat insulation, R38 to take it up to that R49 or blown in, but I understand there's a settling issue. That's one question I have would bat be better tuck tight or blown in? And also I'm insulating a skylight on a 612 pitch, and I've been told I could put a cold air return at the top of that chase around it and reduce or eliminate moisture condensation problems. It's in a bathroom, so I'm concerned about that.
So you have a chase around the skylight. The skylight's high up.
That's correct.
Any way you can get the air to move away from there is probably good. I've not seen the chases, seen the cold air returns. I'd want to see somebody else who had one installed just because the cold air return might be against an outside, the outside of there not insulated, and then might have condensation in it and bring moisture back to your furnace. I just don't know.
Okay, that just kind of goes with the questions you've had previous, and I'm concerned about, one, introducing a warm air source into the attic space, even if it is insulated, and,
right,
again, with that moisture return, because it isn't inoperable. I chose to do it that way, so I'll do some more sourcing on that. What about the settling issue and bat versus blown-in insulation in the attic space?
Well, the bats are not as high density as the, even when they're installed, the cellulose or the fiberglass blown in is puffed up somewhat, but they have to sell it to you at an R value that is the settled R value, not when they put it in at. There are regulations regarding that. The amount of settling, if they put it in at the right, with the right amount of air mixed with it, should not be that great. There have been problems with the bats having a certain amount of loss of insulation value because air gets through the bottom part of it and circulates through. So there's minor disadvantages in both ways, and I haven't seen a definitive study that says one is clearly better than the other at this point. But if you have a reputable dealer putting in the blown-in stuff, it should not settle too much. That was
okay.
A problem for a while with people blowing it a lot. They say, oh, look, you got 14 inches. And in fact, before you... next time you looked up there were 12 or something less.
Sure. Is there a point where there's a diminishing return on your investment? Does that mean, is it possible? And is an R50, some people told me going over R50, you're throwing your money away.
Well, the insulating value the R value decreases proportionally by inch. So every additional inch is a little bit less effective.
Okay.
I mean, okay. In a sort of I'm not sure if it's a smooth curve, but there's a curve that shows that. So you have to figure that point at which, with energy prices and comfort, the R value is no longer worth it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling, Tim. And we'll take some more calls here. Let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jackie.
I did not change the filter in my heating unit because of my husband's health problems. I usually change it when the daylight saving goes on and off. And I called to find out if I could take the filter out while the heating unit was still working. And my heating dealer said, yes, I could. And he said, be careful and make sure that you don't let it get too dirty, because he had two calls where the filters, and they're accordion-type filters in mine, were so dirty that it shut the heating unit down. And I had never heard that. He said, don't panic, but that was the reason for two of the calls. So we should really pay more attention to changing the filters than we have.
That's a good point.
That's a very good point. And, you know, if it says every 3 months or so, you ought to be checking those. You know, like now, when furnaces here in Wisconsin are running almost constantly,
they're going crazy.
A person probably ought to be checking a little more carefully.
Yeah, I thought it was a very good point. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, the older filters, the fiberglass filters, were porous enough that they really couldn't cause the furnace to shut down. But now that people are using more efficient filters to get more of the material out of the air, these filters can become clogged. And if they become sufficiently clogged, well, as they clog up, they progressively decrease the efficiency of the furnace. And at some point, they'll do as the caller said for some furnaces, and they'll shut it down, depending upon the furnace. But certainly, they'll make the furnace work less efficiently. And you, as long as you should not take them out necessarily while the blower is running. I'm not sure that that's going to cause any serious problem, but you can certainly take it out between cycles of the furnace and clean it. Or you can change the thermostat setting so the furnace won't come on for a while and take it out and replace it. And the accordion ones typically are throwaway kind that you replace, but there are dozens of kinds of filters now, so you need to be sure that you follow the instructions that go with that filter.
And John, when you buy a new furnace, oftentimes with these new higher energy furnaces, you're offered the option on several types of an April Air type filter, which is an expensive filter, as opposed to the accordion types that go in. And the sellers say that, well, you only have to replace those once a year or so. Is there any advantage with these new high energy-efficient furnaces to have that? I'm calling it April Air. There's other companies that make it, but I think I hope you know what I'm talking about.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds. I mean, there are HEPA filters, which are very high efficiency, and if you have people with severe allergy problems that related to dust and other things that circulate in the air, they're probably a good idea. The next one down, which is another relatively expensive option. Well, and the HEPA filter, you can't just put in an existing furnace. You need a special blower because it is more resistant than the more conventional filters. There's also an electronic filter, which has a couple of different plates, and it charges the dust particles going through, and then the other plate is oppositely charged and attracts the particles. And those will, if you don't clean those frequently, those can be the attracting plates can be washed and put back in. If you don't do that, they'll spark and they'll do other kinds of things that are not good. So you really have to work at cleaning those. Then there are all these other filters which vary from there on down that are that don't require any power typically, and that are some of them have a electrostatic charge on them to increase the effectiveness, and some of them have varying levels of accordion, pleated filter, I should say, so that they have more surface to collect. If you're basically concerned about dust in your house, filters don't make a real big difference. If you're concerned about dust for health reasons, then you need to be shopping for one of these high efficiency filters.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's go to Michelle in Madison next. Michelle, hello to you.
Hi. I was hoping you could tell me more about getting an energy audit.
Call Focus on Energy.
Focus on Energy?
Focus on Energy.
And they'll send you a list of people who actually do energy audits, and you kind of look and you can find out the person, you know, people that are in your area. In my case, there was Mark Kanvik is a guy in McFarland and did a great job. They spent about 4 hours with you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
You should know that these are not free.
No, they're not. They're $300 is the standard rate, and in the Madison area, MG&E will Madison Gas and Electric picks up $75 of that cost, so it's $225. But then the person will come back at least a couple of times in the beginning, and then after you've done your work or had your work done, come back and check it to see how things have worked out, and that is all covered in that $225 cost. At least it was in my case.
Yeah, that's the standard part of it. They do the previous energy audits that were done for free back in the 70s and early 80s were somebody would come in and they'd look around your house, basically a visual inspection. Now they're doing a lot more high-tech stuff. They're doing the infrared camera to find the hot spots or the cold spots, depending on how you look at it. They're doing a blower door test typically to find out where you might have air leaks. So they're providing a lot of value for the money. They're also coming back, as Larry said, are helping you to figure out which contractors you want to do the work you need to have done, and then following up with you and the contractors to make sure the work is done the way you want it.
So it's pretty comprehensive, and I'm really glad we did it. I think it's going to help our home in the long run. And there's always several things. I could go in and give you a few examples of things that are probably going to be, I know are going to be very simple to fix that are going to make a difference for almost no cost. So, Mark in Janesville, it's your turn next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'm doing a remodel job in an attic. It's an older home, and it's got 2x4 roof rafters, so there's not a lot of room for insulation. And two questions. I was wondering if you thought I should use unfaced insulation or faced insulation, and do you think I need to put roof fence in?
You only have 2x4s to insulate?
Right. Well, the old ones, you know, they're actually almost 4 inches, but not quite.
You should, if you're going to use, if I were in that situation and had no other way to increase the depth of insulation, I would consider using sprayed-in foam.
Sprayed-in foam?
It's more expensive, but it'll give you a higher R value, and it'll reduce the need for a airspace for ventilation. If you're going,
okay.
It's more expensive, but there are a number of people who will put it in for you. I had a cathedral roof on a new room I had added, and we had it put in there. We've been quite happy with it. But if you are going to use the bat insulation, you should put unfaced bats in, and then you should put, or it really doesn't matter too much which kind you use, but typically you put unfaced in, and then you would put a vapor barrier over the top of it. The faced bats, even though they are equipped with what's called a vapor barrier, because there's a space between every bat, they're really not a continuous vapor barrier, so they aren't effective as vapor barriers. Their only value is that they make it easier to install.
All right. Well, and what about the roof vent then? Does it need to be vented somewhere?
Well,
because there's no vent in here whatsoever right now.
Well, and that, if you're going to put 3.5 inches of insulation in, essentially, there's not much space to vent, or you're compromising one way or the other, because you don't have much insulation, and if you put ventilation in, you're going to have even less. And then you will, if you put the ventilation in, then you have to figure a way to have soffit vents at the bottom, and ridge vents somewhere near the top. They don't have to be at the top, but near the top.
Okay. Well, I could put one on the peak, but there'd be a little space above there because I'm dropping the ceiling down a little bit. But I don't know if that would make any difference or not. It's only like a foot.
Well, it makes it easier for you to have the ridge vent will then collect the air from all of the joist spaces, which is an advantage.
That would be good?
That would be good.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And let's see, we'll go take some more calls here in a minute, but I want to remind you, we're talking with John Merrill, housing specialist at the UW Extension. He's an emeritus professor in the School of Human Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Home renovation, repair, and energy on our mind today as we visit with John Merrill. Glad to have you listening in. There's one open line, so give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Jim in Bayfield County next. Jim, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. First, I have two things. First of all, the fellow that called about the moisture on the windows, it might be a good idea to have some fans blowing on those windows anytime it gets real cold to stop that buildup until he can get his problem fixed. Otherwise, some of that moisture might get into the wood, and he might end up with some decay and some graying of the wood and have a lot more work to do.
Yeah.
We've had that problem in the past, and anytime it gets really cold up here where we are, we've got fans blowing on the windows just so we don't have extra jobs to do in the summer.
Oh.
And my question is, I built a house with high-efficiency windows facing the southwest and a lot of insulation. It's got cathedral ceilings, and we do quite well energy-wise, except for we didn't put in air conditioning. We wanted to skip air conditioning. We wanted to use natural breezes and so forth. And in the summer, on still days, it gets really hot in the house, especially around the cathedral ceilings. Now, I put an exhaust fan in one end of that cathedral ceiling, on the gable end, and that worked fine, but in the winter, we had a lot of heat loss out there and moisture buildup behind that wall and a problem with that. And I am calling to find out if there is such a thing as an exhaust fan that seals when it's shut off, some kind of a mechanism that not only shuts the fan off but seals it so you don't have warm inside air going out when you don't want it to.
I have seen them in the catalogs. That they have an inside damper that sort of closes in on them. I'm not sure how tight the seal is, but they definitely have seals, dampers that are supposedly airtight associated with them.
Where might I go to find one of those?
Well, I think dairy equipment, DEC, which makes a lot of dehumidifiers and other things, I think I have seen them in their catalogs. And the other place, and check online for them, and the other place would be the Braun Fan Company, which is a major producer of all kinds of ventilation fans for home and industrial usage.
Okay. Was that first one dairy equipment?
They started off making milk house coolers. Now they make all kinds of other stuff. So it's now DEC International, I think, DEC, or Dairy Equipment Company. But they are they're based in Madison, and they're a major producer of various kinds of energy-efficient ventilation.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And Barb in Milwaukee, it's your turn now. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John.
Hi.
I hope you can help me out. I have a home that was built in the 50s, and I bought it in 1981. The attic was floored in, and there was no insulation in it. The flooring is quarter-inch plywood over tongue and groove over tar paper. And then I think there's another layer of wood under that. And I had insulation blown in under all of that. And I'm wondering if that's a good thing or not a good thing.
Hmm.
Well, it's not a bad thing.
What is it? I'm concerned about the vapor barrier.
Many houses do not have vapor barriers.
Okay.
It's ideal to have them. If you don't have one, then you need to be a little more careful about keeping your moisture levels down, your humidity levels down in your house.
Okay. Now, I just went up in the attic, and I noticed that all the nails have got frost on them.
But this is above the insulation, right?
Yes.
It's cold up there.
Okay. Now, if I want to put a room up there, I would have to then insulate the rafters. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. And the vapor barrier would go on the inside, not against the roof.
Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Barb, someone else had that question as well, John, and asked, did John really mean to say that a vapor barrier should go over the insulation? And you're saying, yes, that's correct.
Vapor barriers always go on the warm side.
Okay. All right, Dave and DeSoto, it's your turn now. Hi, Dave.
Hello there. This is a response to the caller who was doing a little remodel on his cathedral ceiling.
Yes.
Just a couple callers ago. I don't know how big it is, but one solution that he could do is, and I believe he's talking about his rafters, not his ceiling joist, is put another 2x4 rafter directly underneath the rafters he has, and then you would have to nail on like a quarter inch or a 3/8 strip of plywood. This is going to double your joist or your rafter space up there. And because 3.5 inches of insulation in Wisconsin is, I think, ridiculous.
I agree.
And so he could go 2x4 or even 2x6. You know, I don't know how much room he has. If you're going to run a ridge vent and a soffit vent, you must run a baffle all the way up and down every joist or rafter space. Otherwise, you will not have ventilation, and you will have a moisture problem on your roof board. I'll agree with you on the tucked-in insulation, or I call it friction fit. Now, if you add a little plywood between each joist space, it's going to make it a little snugger, and that's fine. And also, yes, the vapor barrier goes on the inside. It's just a suggestion. The guy should at least double his rafter space.
Oh.
Minimum. I've been a carpenter for 35 years. I've done multiple remodels on farm homes and all sorts of things. It's a solution, 2x4 or even 2x6 underneath it. It's going to beef up his roof in the first place. It's going to give him more joist space. You must run a baffle, a little styrofoam baffle, up and down every joist space, or you will not have ventilation. You can put the ridge vents and the soffit vents in, and nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're going to get a moisture problem.
John, comment?
Well, I mean, I agree with him generally. The baffles are always needed from the soffit up over the wall, and if there's very little airspace there, which there would be if you try to put 3.5-inch bats in, you're not going to get good ventilation because there won't be enough space, and the insulation may blow around enough to mean there's no no ventilation space.
Yeah.
So
my understanding was that the guy was doing a cathedral ceiling, and if you have a flat ceiling or an 8-foot ceiling, whatever height,
mm-hmm.
then your little baffles down at the wall are necessary mm-hmm. only. But if you're going cathedral, you must protect the whole roof.
Yeah.
Well, you have to make sure there's airspace. And if you have enough depth of airspace, I'm not sure you need that. But if in his case, he won't have much, he doesn't have much to play with, and that's what I was...
Well, if he puts an inch and a half baffle in there,
yeah.
then he's going to get an inch and a half insulation.
Right.
Yeah.
So you lose an inch and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good points. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Greenwood, your turn next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry and John. We've got an old house, about 100 years old or a little bit more probably, but we've got a gas boiler with hot water, the old cast iron radiators. And this winter we're not heating the upstairs. And I'm basically what I did up there on the radiators is covered them up with blankets and things. That's the only thing I could think of to cut down on the heat loss upstairs because we don't have to have the heat there. But I saw and asked this old house a month or so ago, they had a thermostat that goes on the radiator individually to control each radiator. I'm reluctant to turn the valve off to just stop the water from going up there, but in case it got too cold and it froze up or whatever. But what's the best way to handle that situation?
That's an interesting question. You really need to consult with your heating contractor as to whether it's feasible to shut off your radiators upstairs. But the best way to do it, if they drain down, is to shut them off. If the system is going to have water in it up there, obviously you're correct. You don't want to have them freeze, and you'd have to monitor the temperature. But on many old radiators, hot water radiators are supposed to steam, may drain down, and you may be able to get them to drain down. I have not seen the thermostats for individual radiators, and I'm not sure how they would. I can understand how you could do it in a new system, but you'd have. I can see where they'd be pretty complicated if you had to install it on the radiator.
Mm. All right. Well, we may take up some more of that conversation with John Merrill. We'll take a look at the news and we'll be back. John Merrill, UW Extension Housing Specialist, our guest till 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with John Merrill, UW Extension Housing Specialist, Professor Emeritus, actually, in the UW School of Human Ecology, as we talk home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues. If you have a question for us, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890. Give us a call. John, did you have any other comments for our last caller? We lost that last caller there.
No, I think we
pretty well covered it.
Yeah.
Let's go to Doug in Mount Horeb next. Doug, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Great program. I'd like to suggest to people that call up about the vent preheaters that there are some great small heaters that are direct vent heaters that you can use in the same kind of spaces, in small spaces. And where those don't work, some of the direct vent heaters have blowers on them, small power blowers, too, so you can run a pretty long line out the side of a garage or a shop so you don't have to get into a vent preheater. And the reason I'm suggesting that is I know several people have had some serious problems with those, and I myself and some friends were working in a four-car garage with a vent preheater, and some of the guys that were working there started getting a little silly, and they were marking holes and missing the holes, and we didn't know quite what was going on at first, and then people started feeling sick, and somebody said, you know, maybe it's the vent-free heater that we're using in the garage, and yeah, sure enough, long story short, we ended up taking that heater out of there. We took it back to the place that we bought it, got another one, put it in the space that the people were working in, and we also plugged in a Nighthawk, a carbon monoxide detector, and the first thing that thing did was go off.
Yeah.
And the vent-free heater didn't go off. And we took that one back, and we bought an expensive vent-free heater that had one of these oxygen sensors on it that you're supposed to be able to test by pushing a button, which we did, and it tested fine. We started that heater up. We worked in there for about 2 hours, and the external Nighthawk carbon monoxide detector that we had plugged in went off while the vent-free heater was running, and its sensor did not go off. So, yeah, so anyway, but there are small vented heaters that you can buy now that aren't very much more expensive. They don't take up any more space, and they're a whole lot less dangerous.
Yeah. Good points. John, comment?
No, I appreciate his supporting that.
Yeah, and that's very good information. It's always good to hear from somebody who's had that kind of experience. Thanks, Doug.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it. Kelly in Evansville, it's your turn now. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you guys have probably touched on this several times, but I tuned in halfway through your show. We have a newer home. It was built in 2004, and we've had some problems with severe moisture buildup on these cold nights and even nights that aren't too bad, but there's literally a layer of frost on our windows when we wake up. And I'm wondering if it's because the kind of blinds that we have, they're kind of accordion blinds, and we should leave them up higher, or what suggestion that you might have for us? Because I'm worried about mold or other moisture issues in the wood, like somebody has said.
Sure. Well, any kind of blind is going to, that's sort of airtight, is going to make that window surface colder.
Okay.
So when the nights are cold, and unless the blinds are really tight-fitting,
mm-hmm.
and there are some, Window Quilt is one brand, that run in tracks and are meant to totally keep any air from getting to the window. Those
mm-hmm.
will work. But most blinds are not going to be very good because they're going to allow air to get around them.
Yeah.
And make that window surface cold. So leaving your blinds up at night is a way to avoid that.
And we do try to leave them up just a bit at the bottom, and it seems like the moisture only gathers around the bottom of the window, whereas the rest of the window that is covered with the blind doesn't seem to get the moisture buildup like the bottom does, which is closest to the vents on the floor. So, and I thought, I don't know if the house, because it's newer, is still extracting some moisture from the wood or...
Well, it very well could be that you're having more moisture this year than you would have other years.
Okay.
And it's also been particularly cold.
Sure.
But the fact that you leave them up a little bit is interesting. The air is getting behind there, and it's still... The cold air tends to settle down, so it may be getting trapped up in there and coming down and making the window cooler, but having them up all the way is what I would recommend. Or if they're the louver blinds, if you have some kind of blind that you can open so air can get directly to the window,
mm-hmm.
That would be great too. And if you don't, the other thing you can do this year, particularly given that you may be getting more moisture, is you can on the windows in your bedrooms put the, or the windows that are causing you most problems,
mm-hmm.
put the inside storm windows on it, the plastic that you stretch across the window.
Oh, okay.
That will protect your windows
mm-hmm.
and allow you to still have the privacy of your blinds probably.
Do you suggest with all that frost and moisture buildup to wipe it, you know, obviously wipe it down or as much as you can so that the mold doesn't get into the wood then?
Sure. Keep the windows dry. We have a situation at home where there's a drape we want to draw at night, and in the morning when we put it up, we wipe the window down.
Okay. Okay.
All right, Kelly.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yep. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Phil in Madison next. Phil, hello to you.
Well, thank you. I'd like to introduce something that I think is simpler, and it's on the market, and it's being produced. Any wall or ceiling that does not have a vapor barrier, you go to Sherwin Williams, and they have a paint that's been developed for the prefab homes and the ones that are on wheels. You put that on according to directions, and it establishes a vapor barrier with a paintbrush or some spray equipment. So I suggest they try that and see if that doesn't do the job.
Hmm. What do you think, John?
Well, vapor barrier paints have been around for a while, and they are very effective. They do need to be put on, as I think the caller is inferring, at the recommended rate. You don't spread it thin. You put it on at a fairly good level, thickness. The problem with vapor barrier paints and with many vapor barriers is that most moisture leaks into attics and into walls not through diffusion through material, which is what the paint's taking care of, but through holes in the walls around electrical outlets. Any place that air can be leaking into the wall, it will leak. And when we were working on tri-state homes many, many years ago, the areas that had the greatest problems were around electrical outlets, plumbing chases, things like that. So in addition to making sure that your walls have a low diffusion rate, which is what the vapor barrier would do, that moisture does not go through the materials, you really need to be sure and check for areas where there are leaks. And this is one of the things that the energy audits do, because they provide a blower door test.
Yeah.
And the blower door test is a test where they put a special high-powered blower in place of your front door. Then they go around with smoke pencils and look for any place that air is clearly moving in and out from the walls. And you can figure out where those leaks are, and you can plug them up.
Yep.
May I add something else to
this? Sure.
All electricians are working through the studs, and some of them, of course, get nails in the wire, and then they got a problem. I have, for years, used all electricity like a laboratory where you have the strips on the inside. You can decorate your walls with paper or paint or whatever, and then the electrician comes in, maybe even after the floor is down. So you, and then you can have outlets. You can order them every foot, every 3 feet, and so forth, and the expense. And it eliminates all of this headache that you're talking about. So if people want to do that, it's available.
Good.
Yep, good points. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it. And more callers online, so we'll go to Joel in Door County next. Joel, hi to you.
Well, hello. John, my question for you is about standing seam metal roofs and minimum pitch. I'm looking at building a passive solar home, straw bale design. And just like the other caller talked about with his cathedral ceiling, you end up having a lot of heat gathering up at the top. And I know his southwest-facing orientation puts him at high susceptibility for that. If I have a south orientation, how low can I go with my pitch?
On a standing seam roof?
Yeah.
I am not sure. Clearly, they're meant to have to shed water. And you're better off to have a slope on it where the water will really be shed rather than having any risk of it standing there because of any irregularities. But the manufacturers and distributors, I'm sure, will tell you what the minimum slope is.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Bill in Bayfield County, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello. My question and observation was about ridge vents on homes.
Yes.
I noticed that's the industry standard, and I put them on my home and my cabin. But one thing I was wondering about is they get covered with snow. And I've been up on the roof, and there's like wormholes where the moisture in that tries to get out. But I'm just thinking of going back to gable end vents. Has anybody thought of this or mm-hmm. brought this up?
John?
Well, gable end vents aren't very effective for other reasons. You're right. If you have a lot of snow and you don't have much wind following it, any kind of roof face vent, either the roof pots or the ridge vent, could be covered with snow. The turns out that the biggest time you need the vents, as I understand it, is when the whatever is collected in your attic is thawing and dripping. So if it's ice that's in your attic, which would be the case when you're probably when your ridge vents are covered, that's not as much of a problem as when there's water, when it's warmer. And in that case, the ridge vent would be uncovered and you'd be getting your ventilation. I also want to go back to just beat a dead horse, perhaps, but at least to mention that more than heat, it's air leaking in from the house into the attic area that is the culprit. Air from your basement leaking around your chimney chase or plumbing chases or anything. If you can eliminate that before you before it gets into the attic, you'll have done away with a lot of the moisture that is going to be causing problems in the attic.
Gotcha.
And therefore, you don't need the ventilation. Some research has actually said that attic ventilation is vastly oversold because it's not effective when you need it. And you're talking about a case in which that might be the case. Hmm. So it's better to keep the attic free of any warm air if you can, and then worry less about the attic ventilation.
Thanks, Bill, for calling. Jim and Phillips, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. John, I've got a house with a crawl space. It's about a 4-foot block footing.
Okay.
Or wall with a sitting on a cement footing.
Sure.
And I want to dig out the make a basement underneath it. And I was thinking about putting a new wall on the inside perimeter of the existing footing wall and put a half cement block wall inside of that. What kind of shelf it like?
I've seen that done.
Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. You know, I'm not a structural person. I can't tell you for sure. You'd want to be sure you were not disturbing the support for your foundation wall.
Correct.
But if you were to put a half wall in there and put it in there fairly quickly after it was dug out, I would think you'd be able to maintain the structural soundness of the bearing wall. And I've seen that done in older houses. Lived in one for a while where they dug out a cavity for, you know, a basement area for a furnace. And
uh-huh.
they had a second wall about 4 feet in from the other one that went up so they could put the furnace in there. They hadn't disturbed the outside wall at all. They just started over again with a new one.
That's yeah. what I was thinking of doing, yeah. So it's a possibility to do that. All you get is find somebody to do it.
Somebody to do it and make sure that, given your soils and all that kind of stuff, that, in fact, it will work for you.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Jim. And Mike in Seneca, I believe you're next. Hi, Mike.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two things here quickly comment on. A geothermal seminar, last time you talked to some people called in on that. There is three of them. Let's see here. Eau Claire, La Crosse, and the Wisconsin Dells, and it includes the registration and lunch presentation, questions and answers, and it adjourns. Starts at 11:30, adjourns at 1:30. There's a website, www.ecw.org/geothermal.
Okay.
And that they said anyone could go. There is a fee of $29, but it's kind of geared for dealers or contractors that want to get into this. And it was the focus, and it was put on by Alliant Energy. The other thing I was going to mention that is overlooked as people with forced air add-on furnaces, whether they be oil, gas, or wood, the supply blowers do indeed have bronze sleeve bearings in, and they have to be oiled, as well as the combustion blowers. But that said, some of the oil, newer oil gun-fired ones may have oil-less motors on.
Mm-hmm.
But I take a 3x5 tape at the side of my furnace when I changed my filters last and when I oiled last, when I cleaned the chimney last. So I am abreast of when it needs it again.
Yeah. So those are good points.
Good points. However, for people who are a little less handy, I think another good point is that furnaces need to have somebody check them out, a professional who will check those things but also make sure the heat exchanger is not leaking and other things are operating properly. Today's furnaces are not as simple as they used to be. They have a lot of fail-safes on them, but they still require that a technician look at them every year or two. Two at the most, probably every year, would be recommended.
Mm-hmm.
It's good insurance against a premature failure sometime when it's a cold night and you don't have any heat.
And that's when it always happens, isn't it?
That's right.
It's exactly when it happens.
And having a technician that you've worked with that you can call when that does happen is also helpful.
You're
more likely to get a response if you're a regular customer than if you're calling somebody cold.
Yeah. That's good. Thanks, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. And Lauren in Oshkosh, we'll go to you next. Hi, Lauren.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good.
I have an older house, and it does not have heat upstairs. No heat vents. They had just basically the square holes that the heat would radiate up through the floor. Now, I've lived there for about 12 years, never had heat upstairs. Just whatever comes upstairs, comes upstairs. I tore out the existing chimney, new furnace, new water heater, all vented.
And I was wondering, is the best way to put heat upstairs is go up? I was going to put vent up through the where the chimney was and into the attic and then come out the ceilings. And I'm wondering, is that the best way to get heat up there? And once I get heat up there, is that going to cut down on my heating bill?
No. The latter is no. Why would it cut down on your heating bill?
Well, because all the heat, you know, goes upstairs from downstairs, and then doesn't my heat furnace have to run more?
Only if your upstairs is not insulated properly.
Okay. Well, it's got blown-in insulation.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a farmhouse, so it's still got lath and plaster.
But if you've done a good job of insulating it, adding heat runs to the upstairs is not going to reduce your heat need anymore.
Okay.
I mean, it'll perhaps make your distribution a little bit better and your comfort greater.
Okay.
But you're already heating the upstairs by the gravity feed. Essentially, the heat is rising, warm air is rising. That was one question. The other one was.
What was the other one? I've forgotten myself now.
Going up where the existing chimney was the heat duct.
Yeah, and if you wanted to put them up there, you'd have to be sure that you really heavily insulate them in the attic.
Okay.
Heat runs in attics are very common in warm weather areas. But in our area in Wisconsin, because the fact that you're running heat up there where it's cold, that would be more problematic, I think. You have to really insulate it in order to not have as much of the heat going into your attic as going into your room.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have about 8 inches of blown-in insulation. Is that enough?
Should have 12 at least.
12 at least. So if I did that, that would make the upstairs warmer?
You'd make the upstairs warmer.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Don in Door County, your turn. Hi, Don.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I know we're getting near the end here, but with a couple of the callers, I heard someone with 3.5-inch rafters and trying to insulate that. Would suggest to me possibly a home renovation that's not been properly planned or permitted. And
might
for
be illegal.
Safety, health, and insurance reasons, I would hope you might comment briefly on the necessity to, you know, check into that stuff before you start your own renovations.
Yeah. Good point. John?
Yeah, and I'm not sure where this person was, but, I mean, the codes now require in new construction that you have R38 in the ceilings and that you have ventilation to get the air out of it. So if that's the kind of health thing you're talking about, clearly, you know, that's a requirement now. And when you're planning any kind of remodeling, you want to try to get the whole thing up to code, not just because it'll be legally up to code, but because the code's there for a reason, for the most part, to make it a more efficient house and a safer house.
Yeah, that's very good points. Thanks, Don. Appreciate it very much. And, John, thank you so much.
Well, good to talk with you, Larry.
Yeah, well, have fun in Georgia.
You stay warm.
Yeah, we will. John Merrill, Professor Emeritus and Housing Specialist in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, our guest. And he'll be back again. We'll talk some more about home renovation repair and energy savings with him. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Karen Johansson of Johansson's Greenhouses of Madison will be our guest, so we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.